All right. Welcome, everyone. Today, we're taking a deep dive into Genesis.
Oh, Genesis.
Yeah, those first few chapters, 1 through 3. And we're going to be looking at some excerpts from Dr. Kenneth Matthews' lectures on Genesis.
Okay.
So we're going to be looking at two different creation accounts presented in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. The significance of that Garden of Eden story, and even dive into the question of, were Adam and Eve actual historical figures, or are they symbolic?
I love that.
So many things to unpack here,
yeah.
But it's fascinating how Genesis opens up with those two distinct creation accounts.
Mm-hmm.
So in chapter one, you get that grand, almost poetic overview of God creating the universe, right?
Yes.
But then in chapter two, it's much more detailed. It's a more intimate portrayal of humanity's creation within the Garden of Eden.
It's a fascinating, like, sort of zooming in almost.
Yes. It's like we're given both a panoramic view and then a close-up lens. But what I always find interesting is the deliberate change in the language that's used.
Right.
So in chapter one, you have that very majestic God said, "Let there be light."
Yeah.
You know, very powerful. But then in chapter two, it's much more grounded. You have the Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground.
And it's interesting because that kind of that difference in tone has led some to believe that these accounts contradict each other.
Yeah.
But Dr. Matthews really argues that, no, they're designed to complement each other.
Okay.
So chapter two really elaborates on the creation of humanity and their relationship with God and sort of adds a layer of depth, I think, to that grand narrative that we get in chapter one.
So rather than seeing them as conflicting accounts, we should see them as different facets of the same story.
Right. Precisely. It's like piecing together a puzzle.
Uh-huh.
And each chapter offers a unique piece that kind of contributes to the complete picture.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. Now, we can't talk about Genesis without addressing the elephant in the room, right?
Okay.
The different names used for God.
Yeah.
So we have Elohim in chapter one and Yahweh Elohim in chapter two. So is this just a stylistic choice?
Mm.
Or do these different names signify different aspects of God?
That's a great question. Dr. Matthews has a point on this, and it's, you know, Elohim points to God's power and transcendence as the creator of all things. But Yahweh, particularly when it's paired with Elohim, really starts to reveal this more relational side of God, the God who forms covenants and engages with humanity on a personal level.
And it's so interesting because Yahweh is traditionally associated with God's covenant with Israel.
Right.
And that name is revealed to Moses much, much later.
Mm-hmm.
But to see it here in Genesis, you know, before the establishment of that covenant, it hints at a deeper continuity, don't you think?
Yeah, it's like we're being introduced to a facet of God's character that will be more fully revealed later.
Yeah.
It suggests that God's desire for a relationship with humanity predates any kind of formal agreement or covenant.
Yeah, so even in these early chapters, we get these little glimpses of the God who desires this close personal connection with us. It just makes you wonder if that longing for a relationship was always part of the divine plan.
Right. And I think that shift in the names from that more distant Elohim to the more personal Yahweh Elohim maybe underscores that progression of God's relationship with humanity from creator to covenant maker.
That's fascinating. Now, speaking of relationships, let's step into that iconic Garden of Eden.
Right.
Which is always depicted as this paradise, right?
Mm-hmm.
This place of abundance and beauty with trees pleasing to the eye, and good for food.
You know, it almost makes you wish you could book a little vacation there.
I know. But we need to look beyond that surface and really dive into the symbolic richness of the garden, particularly those two trees that take center stage.
Yes.
The tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
The famous trees.
Every Sunday school kid knows about those trees.
That's right.
But what's the deeper meaning behind them? Were they just these arbitrary tests of obedience? Or is there something more profound going on here?
Yeah, and Dr. Matthews suggests, you know, the tree of life represents access to the source of all life, right? Like a continuous connection to God's presence. So it symbolizes that vitality and sustenance that comes from being in a right relationship with the divine.
So it's not just about a physical tree, but more about that life-giving connection with God, a connection that nourishes and sustains us on a deeper level. What about the tree of knowledge then? Was it just this cosmic don't touch button designed to like test humanity's obedience?
Right. Well, it's not that knowledge itself is inherently bad, but the tree of knowledge, as Dr. Matthews explains, symbolizes the pursuit of wisdom and knowledge separate from God's will. So it represents that human desire to determine right and wrong, good and evil, independently from the divine.
So it's like saying, yes, knowledge is powerful, but without a grounding in that divine wisdom, it can become dangerous.
Exactly.
It can lead us astray.
It can lead us astray. And it's that pursuit of knowledge apart from God that really lies at the heart of the fall, which we see in the following chapter.
But before we get to the fall, let's address one more question. Were Adam and Eve actual people?
Right.
Or are they just these symbolic representations of humanity as a whole?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's a lot of debate about it. Dr. Matthews presents a case for their historicity. He draws attention to the generations or the Toledot superscriptions and those really intricate genealogies that we find throughout Genesis.
Right. Almost like those ancient family trees meticulously documenting the lineage from Adam down to Noah, eventually to Abraham.
Exactly. And Dr. Matthews argues that these carefully constructed literary structures really suggest the author intended Adam and Eve to be understood as real individuals.
Okay, so the way the story is woven into that broader narrative hints at their historicity. But does viewing Adam and Eve as historical figures actually impact how we interpret their story?
That's a great question.
Does it make their actions more literal? Or maybe it even deepens the symbolic significance of their choices?
That's fascinating. And to explore that further, we need to delve into the story of the fall itself.
So the fall. It's a story that's really captivated and perplexed readers for centuries. What do you think makes this story so enduring, so universally resonant, even today?
I think it's because, you know, at its core, the story of the fall speaks to this very deep part of the human experience. You know, that struggle between obedience and desire, the allure of forbidden knowledge, the consequences of our choices.
It's almost like this cautionary tale, a reminder that even in paradise, things can go terribly wrong.
Right. It certainly is. And, you know, going back to those two iconic trees, you know, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they're not just background props. You know, they're key to understanding those dynamics of temptation and transgression.
Right. We were talking about them before.
Yeah.
The tree of life symbolizing that vital connection with God, that source of true life. And the tree of knowledge representing that allure of wisdom, but also that danger of seeking it apart from God's will.
Exactly. And it's interesting how the serpent, that cunning figure in the garden, exploits this very desire for knowledge. He tempts Eve with that promise of becoming like God, knowing good and evil. And it plays on our innate curiosity, our yearning for understanding, for power.
It's like he's offering that shortcut to enlightenment, a way to bypass God's guidance and achieve wisdom on their own terms.
Exactly.
But didn't God specifically forbid them from eating from the tree of knowledge?
Right.
It seemed like a rather arbitrary rule, especially in a place like the Garden of Eden.
It's easy to see it that way. But Dr. Matthew suggests that, you know, God's command wasn't about withholding something good from Adam and Eve.
Okay.
It was about protecting them from the consequences of choosing their own way over God's way.
So it wasn't about the fruit itself, but more about that act of disobedience, that decision to disregard God's command. And it was about trust and recognizing their dependence on God.
Exactly. And this is where I think, you know, free will comes into play. God gave Adam and Eve that freedom to choose, even if that meant choosing wrongly.
Right.
And as we see in the story, that choice has profound consequences, not only for them, but for all humanity.
So the fall wasn't just about breaking a rule. It was about severing that fundamental connection with God, that source of life symbolized by the tree of life.
Exactly. And it's this broken connection, the separation from God that introduces sin and death into the world.
Right.
It casts a shadow over all creation.
Yeah, that is a sobering thought, that a single act of disobedience could have such far-reaching consequences. But before we get too bogged down in the darkness, let's shift gears a bit and talk about the creation of Eve.
Okay.
Her creation story is fascinating. I think it's equally full of symbolic depth. Remember how God says, it is not good for man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him.
Yeah.
I love how God parades all these animals before Adam, almost like this cosmic dating game.
Yeah, like a lineup.
But none of them quite fit the bill.
None of them, right. None of those creatures could provide the companionship and partnership that Adam needed.
Yeah.
And here's where things get interesting, because that Hebrew word for helper, as Dr. Matthews points out, doesn't imply subservience or inferiority.
Okay.
It actually suggests a partner, someone who complements and completes Adam, someone who stands alongside him as an equal.
So more like a dynamic duo, you know, power couple, rather than this hierarchical relationship where one is subordinate to the other.
Exactly. Precisely. And the way Eve is created, from Adam's side, rather than his head or his foot, further emphasizes this idea of equality and partnership. You know, they're two halves of the same whole, both essential to God's plan for humanity.
It's such a beautiful way to portray that relationship between man and woman, rooted in that mutual respect and partnership, shared purpose.
Absolutely.
But what about the whole rib thing?
Yeah.
Is that meant to be taken literally, or is there a deeper meaning behind that?
Right. And that's a question that's, you know, puzzled a lot of readers. And Dr. Matthews notes that the Hebrew word that's often translated as rib can also be translated as side.
Okay.
So it's not necessarily about a specific bone. It's more about emphasizing that close connection between Adam and Eve, how they're literally made from the same substance.
So less about anatomical accuracy, more about conveying that symbolic truth about their interconnectedness.
Exactly.
And don't overlook that detail about Adam falling into a deep sleep during Eve's creation. What's that all about?
Right. So Dr. Matthews suggests that this sleep serves two purposes. First, it allows God to perform this act of creation without causing Adam any pain. But more importantly, I think it emphasizes that Eve is a unique creation, not just a modified version of Adam.
Sure.
She has her own distinct identity and purpose.
No cloning going on in the garden?
No cloning going on in the garden.
I appreciate that clarification.
Yeah.
But what are the implications of their creation as male and female? How does that relate to this concept of human sexuality?
Right. And that's a topic that gets, you know, often muddled with a lot of cultural baggage and theological debates. But, you know, Dr. Matthews makes a crucial point here that human sexuality, as depicted in Genesis, is a good and beautiful gift from God.
It's refreshing to hear that, because religion doesn't always have the best track record when it comes to embracing sexuality.
Right. It's often been a point of contention. But Dr. Matthews emphasizes that the creation of both male and female, that differentiation of the sexes, is part of God's blessing. It's not something to be ashamed of or repressed. You know, it's part of what makes us human. It's part of our God-given identity.
So the message here isn't sex is bad. It's more about recognizing that it's this powerful force, this sacred gift that should be approached with respect and responsibility.
Exactly.
And within the context of a loving relationship.
Exactly. And that's a message that's incredibly relevant today, especially in a world that's, you know, just saturated with sexual imagery, but often lacking a healthy understanding of what it means to be sexual beings. Genesis reminds us that sexuality isn't just about physical pleasure.
Right.
It's about connection, intimacy, and it's about, you know, the potential for creating new life. It's about that union of two souls, a reflection of the divine image in which we were created.
Those are some powerful insights.
Yay.
But let's circle back to the story of the fall. What deeper meaning can we glean from this tale of temptation and transgression?
Well, you know, I think the fall serves as a reminder that even in the midst of paradise, even with all of God's blessings, we still have the capacity to choose poorly. We can choose to prioritize our own desires over God's will, and those choices can lead us down a path of pain and separation.
Yeah, it's a reminder that we're not infallible, even in a perfect setting.
Yeah.
But is the story of the fall just a tale of human failure? Or is there a glimmer of hope amidst all that darkness?
Well, I think it's important to remember that even though the fall has these, you know, devastating consequences, God doesn't abandon humanity.
Okay.
He continues to pursue us, continues to offer grace and redemption.
So even in the midst of our brokenness, there's that promise of restoration.
Absolutely. And I think that's a crucial takeaway from Genesis.
Okay.
Yes, we make mistakes, we fall short, but God's love and mercy are always available to us.
It's a powerful reminder that even when we stray from the path, there's a way back, a path towards reconciliation and healing. Speaking of paths, I'm curious about that concept of the proto-evangelium that Dr. Matthews mentions.
Right.
What is that exactly, and how does it relate to the story of the fall?
Yeah, so the proto-evangelium, often referred to as the first gospel, is found in Genesis 3.15.
Okay.
Where God tells the serpent, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel." And it's seen as this foreshadowing of the eventual victory over sin and death through Jesus Christ.
So even in this early account of human transgression, there's that hint of hope, a promise of future redemption.
Exactly. It's this subtle but profound message of hope that's woven into the fabric of the fall narrative. It suggests that God's plan for humanity's salvation was already in motion, even in the face of their rebellion.
A reminder that God's grace is always at work, even in the darkest of times. So as we wrap up this deep dive into Genesis, what are some key takeaways you think our listeners should ponder as they reflect on these ancient stories?
Well, you know, I think Genesis really invites us to consider some some really fundamental questions about our relationship with God, with ourselves, with the world around us.
Mm-hmm.
It challenges us to really examine our desires, our choices, and those consequences that flow from them.
It reminds us that we were created for connection with both God and with each other. But sin and brokenness have fractured those relationships.
Yeah, and it encourages us to seek restoration, to lean into God's grace, and to navigate the complexities of life with wisdom and humility.
It's a reminder that even though we stumble and fall, there's always a path back to wholeness, a path that leads toward healing and reconciliation.
And that path begins with acknowledging our need for God's guidance and surrendering to his transforming love.
What a powerful way to sum up the message of Genesis. These stories aren't just dusty relics of the past, but living narratives that continue to speak to us, to the depths of the human experience.
I think so, too. Genesis, with its rich symbolism and these profound insights, timeless themes, it invites us to engage with those big questions of life, of faith, and our place in this grand scheme of creation.
Absolutely. It's a journey of discovery that I encourage all of you to embark on. Keep digging, keep questioning, and keep seeking those deeper layers of meaning. Until next time, keep diving deep into the world of faith and knowledge.